It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an Ozaukee County judge found the Wisconsin Elections Commission in contempt of court in a hearing today. We'll discuss why and what comes next. First, some very good medical news came out recently. The rate of deaths from cancer in the United States dropped 2.2% from 2016 to 2017. That's the single largest drop in 1 year that's been recorded. And it may be surprising to know that a reduction in lung cancer deaths is a big reason for that change. Dr. Kurt Edel is medical director for oncology at Gunderson Health System and is based in La Crosse. He's also the past president of the Wisconsin Association of Hematology and Oncology. Dr. Edel, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this subset of cancer, lung cancer. Out of cancer deaths in the U.S., how big a part of that is from lung cancer generally?
Actually, a very large part of this. A lung cancer, unfortunately, has the highest mortality of all cancers. In fact, many cancers, breast, colon, melanoma combined, don't equal the death rate from lung cancer. So if you make a change in lung cancer, you kind of like all other cancers follow when you look at large cancer statistics.
And is that pretty much across the board that lung cancer is that large a percentage? Does that hold true here in Wisconsin and even maybe in other countries as well?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, in other countries where the smoking rate is higher, that's even more the case. Absolutely.
So the data from 2017 shows a significant drop in cancer deaths in the U.S. How big a change is that 2.2%? What does that really mean?
It means that, and that's a big deal. So anytime we see the cancer rate drop is huge. And recently we've been seeing that rate drop sort of consistently year in and year out. But what made this one so different was the degree of drop. So when you translate that 2.2 from 2016 to 2017, and remember that looking at this data, it always lags from the time that cancer registries can report out. So it always lags by a year or two. But, we're talking several hundred thousand people, you could say, did not die that we would have anticipated dying from cancer. And again, lung cancer is sort of the biggest in that group.
And I'm guessing because you said lung cancer is responsible for a large portion of those cancer deaths in the U.S. and that it dropped that much, other cancer is not dropping as much. I'm guessing that means that lung cancer actually dropped even more than that 2.2%.
Perhaps, yes. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And are
go ahead, please. No, it's just that, when you start to ferret out, where that happens, there's a lot of geographic and a lot of nuances in the data, looking at ethnic, which by and large, we also saw a decrease in the ethnic spread of cancer. So the disparities was also going down, which is very good.
I believe that what you're referring to is that people of color, African Americans in particular, had a higher rate.
Yes. Yeah. And unfortunately, those racial disparities have always been there. And we're starting to see that gap close.
One of the questions that I had in looking at this reporting is, are we seeing fewer cases of lung cancer, or is it that more people are surviving it?
The latter. More people are surviving. Now, having said that, I can't say that the incidence, the number of people getting lung cancer or other cancers, has dropped nearly as much as the number of people who have died of the disease. And part of that has to do with the treatments that we have these days. So more people are living with their cancer than dying of their cancer. And that's what some of this data reflects.
We're talking with Dr. Kurt Edel right now. He's medical director for oncology at Gundersen Health System, and he's based in La Crosse. We're talking about the good news that lung cancer deaths have decreased significantly, and in turn, that has brought down the U.S. cancer deaths quite a bit. And what are some of the most common causes of lung cancer, Dr. Edel? What should we be aware of?
Well, far and away, the elephant in the room is the smoking rate. And what we have consistently seen is the rate of smoking decline across the U.S. Now, here's where you see a lot of sort of geographic differences. So California probably has seen one of the most significant decreases in smoking rates, whereas, you know, there are areas in Kentucky, West Virginia, the Carolinas, that haven't seen nearly that drop. And we can start to look and say the incidence of smoking, as that drops, we're going to start to see the incidence of smoking or of lung cancer drop. But that is separated by a good 10, if not more, years. So the advances that we see in smoking cessation for this kind of study don't play out for 10 or 15 years down the road.
And you said that obviously smoking is the biggest cause of lung cancer, but are there others?
Yeah, so certainly radon. We also know that there's a degree of family history, but we just don't know to what degree or that we can pinpoint, like we can say for breast cancer or other inheritable risk factors with that we can with other types of cancer.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Jennifer in Fitchburg is up. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. So I have a question for the doctor. So smoking and lower socioeconomics is associated, lower socioeconomics and being a person of color overlaps and is also correlated with a greater likelihood of smoking. So my question is, do you think that Medicaid expansion at all contributed to people getting assessed earlier, getting treatment, and who may have died in the past were actually able to have successful treatment? And so I guess the underlying question is, do you see this as more success with treating cancer or a change in health policy that got people more people covered and in to be assessed and treated at a earlier stage?
Thanks so much for that call, Jennifer. Dr. Edel?
Yeah, so both. What's really interesting is when you start to look at healthcare policy, just having health insurance increases your survival if you have a cancer diagnosis. And that spans sort of no matter what cancer you have. Also, having health insurance will, by and large, we see more cancers diagnosed at earlier stages where cancer is better treated. Yeah. So states who have had Medicaid expansion, who have had more screening, this is where we start to see the benefit. Absolutely.
Thanks for that call, Jennifer. We are talking with Dr. Kurt Edel right now. He's medical director for oncology at Gundersen Health System, and he is based in La Crosse. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about reducing your risk of lung cancer? Are you a cancer survivor? Tell us your story. If you've survived lung cancer, we'd especially like to hear about your experiences. Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the drop in U.S. cancer deaths with Dr. Kurt Edel. He's medical director for oncology at Gunderson Health System and is based in La Crosse. He's also the past president of the Wisconsin Association of Hematology and Oncology. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you adopted lifestyle habits with the idea of minimizing your cancer risk? What have you done? If you've survived cancer, how did it change you? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Dr. Edel, I know that when my mother died of lung cancer in 1982, the treatment options were not very good, and both the radiation and chemo were nowhere near as sophisticated as they are now. It was a pretty brutal course of treatment, I have to say.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. What advances have we seen in the last few decades?
Well, certainly we've made many advances in just sort of standard chemotherapy, but more recently, and I think what's really changed the sort of landscape of cancer, not just lung cancer, but many cancers in general, has been the discovery of immunotherapy, the idea that we can harness your own immune system to recognize your cancer. And those therapies have seen dramatic improvements. We've seen that in lung cancer. We've seen that really play out initially in melanoma, skin cancer, as well as kidney cancer, renal cell. And those treatments have not only far extended patients' lives far beyond what we would ever have anticipated when we first started looking at this, but it's also improved their quality of life.
Let's go to the phones, and Mark in Clear Lake is up. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question about some of the preventative, actually early detection of lung cancer tests that are being promoted now. I'm just curious if that's worth one's time to do that. I may have quit smoking 15 years ago, but I started, you know, I probably smoked for 25 years, and I don't know if that would be worth my time, or is that even a possibility?
Great question, Mark. Thanks for that. Dr. Edel?
Yes, great question. So what we have seen in lung cancer is that there is a very good screening tool, just like a colonoscopy for colon cancer or a mammogram for breast cancer, a CT scan of the chest. And many of the criteria for that scan, because we're starting to look at patients who would be at risk. So, Mark, you're right in there. The technical sort of qualifications for that CT scan are a 30-pack year smoking history. So, for example, if you smoked a pack a day for 1 year, that's a one-pack year history. So, for patients who have smoked 30 pack years or more, whether they're currently smoking or they quit smoking, are between the ages of 55 and like 75, that ballpark, you're eligible for a screening CT scan of the chest. And we know that for patients who get that scan, that we are reducing the mortality that is dying of lung cancer. So first things first is talk that over with your primary care physician. We also know that the number of people who are eligible but who actually get screened are very low. That is, there's many people who are eligible but few that actually get screened.
Mm-hmm. And so Mark talking to his doctor and asking to get that screening would probably be the next best step?
Absolutely, yes.
Great. Thanks for that call, Mark. Let's go now to Stephen in Eau Claire. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Go ahead.
My question is that it's great the things you're doing to lower the rates of cancer and survival, but do you have statistics on how well they function after surviving it? And do they function well? Are they healthy? Are they still non-functioning but surviving?
Thank you for that call.
Yes, that's a great question. And what we're seeing, particularly with some of the new therapies, is not just people living longer, but people living with better quality of life. So as medical oncologists or cancer doctors, our biggest goal is to turn cancer into a chronic disease, but yet a maintaining quality of life chronic disease, such as, you know, patients living with diabetes or arthritis or heart disease. It's something that you live with, are able to function with, and not be so debilitated. And that's one of the beauties of many of the new treatments that we have.
We're talking right now with Dr. Kurt Edel. He is medical director for oncology at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. He's also the past president of the Wisconsin Association of Hematology and Oncology. We're talking about the significant drop in U.S. cancer deaths, specifically lung cancer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Dr. Edel, we talked about the fact that smoking is just a huge issue for lung cancer. Are you particularly concerned about the impact of this pretty significant increase in vaping on lung health?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, and people will take issue with this, but I think vaping is the is a gateway drug to smoking. And I think vaping is really just a wolf in sheep's clothing. We know that where manufacturers are targeting, particularly the adolescent population, that if you can get them hooked on vaping, they're more likely to turn in the smokers, you know, in decades down the road. Even though there's data right now that the manufacturers would say, well, vaping is actually a way to decrease smoking. But I think that, again, I think that's a wolf in sheep's clothing, because I think what we're going to see is this being a gateway drug to smoking.
Let's go now to John in Toma. Hi, John.
Hello. How are you guys this afternoon?
Good. Thanks for calling in. What would you like to share?
Well, I'm a cancer survivor myself. Back in 1990 to 91, that whole year, basically, I was treated for Hodgkin's lymphoma. I believe I got it from the cranberry marsh that I worked on, from the pesticides, the Roundup and stuff like that. You hear about that nowadays. But anyway, it was a rough treatment. It was radiation and chemotherapy combined. And nowadays, the Hodgkin's, all the lymph nodes were swollen up around in my chest area and everything, around my heart, and that's where they did the radiation. And nowadays, I have congestive heart failure.
Yeah.
And someone had told me that could be related to the radiation treatment.
Thanks for that call, John, and so glad that you came out on the other side of that. Dr. Edel, is that an unfortunate result of some cancer treatments?
It certainly can be, yes. You know, and then, you know, that's really, you know, what we're trying to avoid as we move into the future, is that not only can we treat patients and make them live longer, but can they have less sequelae, less sort of long-term side effects of their treatment. But yes, unfortunately, that is very possible that congestive heart failure can result from the treatment that you had, you know, decades ago. Yes.
Well, thanks again for sharing your story, John. Let's go now to Philip in Milwaukee. Hi, Philip.
Hi. I'm curious about, so after hearing about studies pertaining to smoking, in particular cigarette smoking, do the same ideas translate to cannabis use, or is there data about that yet?
Thanks for that, Philip. And certainly, Dr. Edel, with cannabis being approved for especially recreational purposes in a lot of states now, is that something that's really, you know, strongly on your radar?
It is, you know, and one of the problems is cannabis use, particularly smoking cannabis, doesn't have a lot of regulation in the sense of, like, what's in your cigarette, what's in your joint. So the smoking, you know, it's kind of a little bit of like the Wild West. It's not nearly as regulated. So it's, for lack of a better term, buyer beware.
And also with cannabis, I'm guessing that a lot of people are smoking it with no type of a filter as well.
Exactly. So, you know, what else is there that we don't know, or we, you know, like I say, it's hard to regulate and control.
Thanks for that call, Philip. And Dr. Edel, we talked about lung cancer, and also you mentioned melanoma, skin cancer, as showing signs in the right direction. But unfortunately, there are some areas in which progress seems to have stalled: colorectal, breast, and prostate cancers. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up, because let me address first, you just mentioned melanoma. What's interesting about this study, looking at the data, was that because of the new therapies that are out, particularly in melanoma and renal, where we really know that immunotherapy, drugs that boost your immune system, have made the biggest difference, we were seeing this drop in melanoma death rates while the incidence was actually going up. So that really argues that people are living longer with this disease, and it really tells us that our therapies are working. I'm glad you brought up the colorectal, breast, and prostate, because, yes, we've seen those incidents drop, but they seem to have plateaued. And as I've just said, you know, smoking is one of the biggest risk factors. What we're starting to see is obesity replacing smoking as one of the biggest risk factors. And when you look at obesity rates, those are the cancers, breast, prostate, and colorectal, where obesity is starting to play a bigger risk factor than other risk factors.
And Dr. Edel, before we let you go, while each type of cancer has its own risk factors, are there general guidelines that can help us better our chances of not developing cancer?
Healthy lifestyle. So, as I tell my patients, those dirty words, diet and exercise, and, you know, maintaining a healthy body weight and not smoking. You know, if our population were committed to those two, I think we would see dramatic improvements in not just the incidence, but also the death rates.
Well, Dr. Edel, thank you so much for joining us today. It was very informative.
Hey, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Dr. Kurt Edel is Medical Director for Oncology at Gundersen Health System and is based in La Crosse. He joined us to talk about a significant drop in U.S. cancer deaths from 2016 to 2017. Coming up after the news, we talk about what happens next now that the State Elections Commission was held in contempt of court for failing to remove 230,000 names from the Wisconsin voter rolls. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, the trade war with China has been a challenge for a lot of U.S. companies, but it's been a busy time for the lobbying industry. We'll find out how the businesses that can afford to pay for lobbyists are trying to avoid tariffs and get a leg up on their competitors. First, a circuit court judge in Ozaukee County today decided to hold several members of the Wisconsin Elections Commission in contempt of court. Three members and the commission itself each face a daily fine. That is, until they comply with Judge Paul Malloy's order to clear more than 200,000 outdated Wisconsin voter registrations from the state's voter rolls. For more on the story, we're joined by Sean Johnson. Sean is WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Judith.
So you were listening into the hearing today. How significant or surprising is Malloy's decision to hold them in contempt?
I guess it's significant to have a judge hold, you know, somebody in a state office in contempt. It's just something that you don't see very often. We've had a lot of cases in Wisconsin involving voting laws, and I can't recall a contempt hearing actually taking place and a judge issuing an order like this. So, you know, on the one hand, like $250 a day, it's not a gargantuan figure. I think it's more just the finding of contempt by a judge against three, you know, members of the Elections Commission, not all the members. Mm-hmm. That's kind of interesting.
What was the tone of the judge especially?
He said he was, kind of felt disrespected by the commission for not following his order from 1 month ago now, when he said that the state must immediately purge the names of up to 200,000 230. It was at the time, it was up to 232,000 people we thought could be purged. That number is now lower, but the commission has met twice to consider his ruling from December 13th. Both times, the commission deadlocked on what to do next, because you have three Republicans, three Democrats on the commission, and they now view this case very differently. The three Democrats both times voted to not do anything, you know, just kind of wait until the appeals proceed in this case. And Judge Beloy was not happy with that. You know, he said it's a judge's order. You have to follow it. And so the order, the contempt order that he laid down today is what followed.
Remind us how we got to the point where we are today.
Yeah, what happened is this all stems from this system that Wisconsin is a part of, this multi-state system that tracks voter registration addresses and matches it up with other government addresses. So it matches it up with, like, Department of Motor Vehicle addresses, for example, and it flags people who it thinks may have moved. And so what happened is this system flagged 232,000 people who may have moved. And the state elections commission voted unanimously to send them a mailing saying, hey, we have flagged you as a potential mover. That same mailing, though, did not say we're going to remove you from the voter registration rolls. So that's where this gets a bit complicated, is that the state's plan, the elections commission's plan, was to let these people know we think you've moved, but leave them on the rolls until 2021 if it didn't hear back from them. And so what happened is Judge Malloy agreed with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, a conservative think tank and legal, you know, law firm, essentially, that that was not the law, that the Elections Commission had to remove these people from the rolls. And so that's kind of where we find ourselves today. Is that,
so Will had filed a lawsuit on this issue.
Yeah, that's what got this to his courtroom, is that Will, this conservative group, filed the lawsuit, said that once you identify these names, once you send them this mailing, you have 30 days. They have 30 days to respond. If they don't, you take them off the list. And it's a clean cut case, according to Will. Judge Malloy saw it that way. The state is appealing this. I mean, there's an appeal in the state appeals court. There's an attempt to take a direct appeal to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. There's another offshoot case in federal court. Democratic elections commissioners were saying, let's wait for some of these appeals to play out before we take any action. Judge Malloy said, no, I am a judge. I issued an order. You have to follow it.
We are talking with Sean Johnson. He is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. We are talking about the decision that holds the State Elections Commission in contempt of court for not purging the voter rolls. And Sean, let's listen to a little bit of Judge Malloy talking about this case.
If people are free to disregard a court's order, then where do you start and stop with that? How do you enforce that? What happens to our justice system if people can just say, well, that's one guy's interpretation of the statute? Sure, it's one guy's interpretation, but he's a judge. That's what he's paid to do.
And I think Judge Malloy, they're referring to something that the defendants had said, the defendant's lawyer saying, well, it's just one person's opinion.
Yeah, it was what happened is that you had Democratic members of the Elections Commission on these two meetings that the commission had since Judge Malloy's ruling, coming out and saying it's going to be up to a higher court to decide this. We shouldn't act too quickly here because this is going to be handled by a higher court. Judge Malloy said, you know, you don't get that option, essentially.
So obviously we are now fully in the year 2020. It is a big presidential election year, a lot riding on Wisconsin. Put this story in that larger kind of context for us.
Yeah, I think number one, I don't know that we would even pay attention to this story if we didn't live in a state like Wisconsin, where there's, I mean, so much riding on our electoral votes in the next election based on how the map is kind of shaping up. And just how close we have been in Wisconsin. I mean, our last few elections, the state Supreme Court last year, the race for governor in 2018, the race for president in 2016, all decided by around 1%, some less, you know, some more. You can even go back to the 2000 and 2004 presidential races, which were even closer than the 2016 presidential races. We are a very close state. And so you kind of start with that and you realize why so much attention is paid anytime you're talking about a couple hundred thousand voters who might be removed from the voting rolls. That's kind of where this why there's so much of a spotlight here. And then I guess you look at where these voters live. And, you know, while they're all treated equally under the law, under this ruling, practically speaking, many of them live in cities that tend to support Democrats. You know, they're voters who are more apt to have moved. They might be college voters. And so if they are more apt to support Democrats, practically speaking, it could be more of a hardship on the Democratic Party going into this crucial election year.
And there are those who say, well, it's still not a big deal because we have same day voter registration in Wisconsin. But what are some of the hurdles for that?
You just have to have the right information. I mean, if somebody is going in thinking they're registered and they're not, it creates complication to their vote that, you know, they wouldn't have had otherwise. So, yeah, you can register to vote same day in Wisconsin. And I think if you're listening and wondering, am I registered right now? You go to myvote.wi.gov and you can check it. Is one thing you can do. I mean, if you're one of these people who was flagged by the state and you got notice from the state, you can pop on there, enter your information and say, yeah, I still live at my address. You know, if you think you've mistakenly been flagged as moving. So there are all sorts of ways that the state can address this. The political parties, the Democratic Party in particular, has said that it's going to be doing a lot of outreach to make sure that anybody who is, you know, mistakenly removed from the list is added back on. Most of the people actually who were flagged by the system will have moved. Okay, so you are talking about kind of a small subset of people within this a larger group of people. But again, in a state as close as Wisconsin, there's a reason that we're paying attention to a couple hundred thousand voters.
So if they go to that website and repeat it for us again?
It's myvote.wi.gov.
So if they go there, since the purge hasn't happened yet, will they be able to tell? Is it just looking and making sure that it's the right address?
Yeah, they'll be able to see. I mean, if they were one of the people who was flagged, they got a letter. And so they would be able to follow steps in that letter. But, you know, I did it before I went on just to kind of refresh on how it works. You enter your name and your birth date. Sometimes there are errors in that information, too. And if there is, you can contact your local clerk. But that is sort of where things start. You can also register online in Wisconsin now, which is something that's been the case for a few years now. So as far as what the Elections Commission is going to do next, they actually meet tomorrow to take this up. And I don't know what they're going to do. Obviously, the judge has sent kind of a loud message, legally speaking, and they have to decide how they're going to proceed. But, you know, it could be a situation where they send out an additional mailing with new instructions or, you know, maybe not. That was an option that's been before then with a previous meeting. They have some decisions to make at tomorrow's meeting.
And one of the arguments I believe that the defense was making was that the judge had not actually put a deadline on them acting on it. He said that he used the word forthwith, which means quickly, right, or expediently. Did he, in this contempt ruling, put a hard deadline on something?
I'm not certain I heard an immediate date. I think he's fining the members of the commission on a per day basis until they do this. And he's fining the three Democratic members of the commission who had voted against taking, you know, steps toward moving forward. That's not what Will, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, had suggested. They said, fine all the commissioners. He focused his fine on the three Democratic commissioners who had said we need to stand put until this is handled by higher courts.
Well, Sean, thanks for joining us, and we will definitely be keeping watch on this story.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol Bureau Chief and co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. We talked with him today about an Ozaukee County judge holding the State Elections Commission in contempt for failing to remove thousands of voters from the state rolls. Coming up, we'll find out how the trade war with China has deepened the gap between companies that can afford the help of Washington lobbyists and those that can't. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, Iran admitted over the weekend to shooting down a passenger airliner that killed nearly 180 civilians on board. We'll look at the fallout and get analysis of the latest developments in that country. First, trade disputes with China and other countries have saddled U.S. manufacturers with import tariffs during the last 2 years, forcing some companies to cut costs or pass the bill along to customers in the form of higher prices. However, the trade war has been good business for at least one industry, Washington lobbyists. Companies are looking to lobbyists to help them avoid tariffs, but that comes with a big price tag. Some business owners and politicians are worried it's created an imbalance between companies that can afford lobbying help and those that can't. Lydia DePillis is a reporter covering trade and the economy for ProPublica. Lydia, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So the trade disputes of the past couple of years, especially with China, have been challenging to many U.S. companies that import some or all of their products. What kind of services are companies looking to lobbying firms to provide?
So primarily what companies really need is specialized trade lawyers who can tell them exactly how to make the argument for an exclusion from tariffs. So just it's important to know that all of the tariffs that have been imposed so far come with an exclusion process. And it's a way in which companies can make their case to either the Commerce Department or the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative to say, look, we can only get this product from China. There's no way to get it anywhere else. It would be devastating to our company to have to pay the tariffs. And also, this product is not the target of Chinese industrial policy. It's not something that they're trying strategically to take over, like electric vehicles or certain types of computer chips. So they really need folks who know Washington and know the staff of the U.S. Trade Representative to make sure that they make their case perfectly. What a number of firms have also been doing is hiring lobbyists who are more specifically meant to make connections with lawmakers who can make, you know, strategic calls to the White House or other public officials to say, look, can you please take another look at my constituent company's application? So that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of help that they need.
And the lobbying industry is only required to disclose so much, but do we have a sense of how much more business they're getting since the trade disputes have started up?
Yeah, so we took a look at the number of clients that are lobbying on trade issues over time. And it was pretty steady throughout the 2000s, and then it jumped a lot, 28% from 2017 to 2018. And we only have data through September so far, but it's already almost surpassed the last year with another quarter of data pending. So we're pretty sure it's going to be head and shoulders above anything we've seen before. That's just the number of clients. It's too hard to tease out the amount of money that they are actually spending on lobbyists, but I think some of those bills are pretty high, just judging from a few that we've seen so far.
Only certain companies obviously can afford lobbying. One of those companies you wrote about was the Wisconsin manufacturer Primex, which makes temperature and time monitors. Can you tell us about their efforts to try and avoid the heavy toll that these tariffs are taking?
Yeah, so Primex has been out there pretty publicly trying to both demonstrate the impact of tariffs on Heartland businesses and also try to achieve exclusions for several dozen, actually up 200, they did 200 applications, which many of their products are very, very similar, so there may be some overlap in there. And they hired a firm called Michael Best Strategies, which has as its principals several Wisconsin political figures, or folks who've been active in the administration, Scott Walker, over time. And so that firm has been popular among many Wisconsin companies, actually. And it also has, as its chair of its board, I believe, Ryan Priebus, who was President Trump's first chief of staff way back at the beginning of the administration. So they do both sides. They both do legal help and composing of those applications and also the lobbying, where they do proactive outreach to public agencies, the White House and the Hill. And so they have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, the CEO told me, on this process, both in the form of staff time, trips to Washington, bills for those lawyers and lobbyists, and they've had mixed results so far. Some of their things have been approved, some of them have been denied. A lot of those approvals, the CEO told me, came after resubmitting their applications on the advice of their lawyers. So this is expensive advice, but it can really help if they receive an answer that gives them some guidance as to how they could improve their application, and so they send it back in again for another look. And they also got help from Senator Ron Johnson, who made a call to USTR, and the CEO told me also communicated their situation to the president himself as part of a number of companies in Wisconsin who are struggling with tariffs and the exclusion process.
We're talking right now with Lydia DePillis. She's a reporter covering trade and the economy for ProPublica. We're talking about how the tariffs and the trade war with China has been a boon for the lobbyist business. What about some business owners who have not been able to access the same kind of resources and support? You spent time with a South Carolina business owner whose products were affected by the tariffs. Tell us a little bit about Mike Elrod.
That's right. So Mike Elrod, he has a import business in Charleston that he sources small, efficient water heaters for several niche markets in China. And he's worked over the course of, 15 years to develop different models and improvements. And so the suppliers that he works with are pretty specialized, and he thinks it'll be really, really hard to just pick up and move to some other country. But he also doesn't have a ton of extra cash to spend on legal help. So what he did was look at the applications that have been filed so far and kind of do a similar job and follow the instructions as carefully as he could. And so he filed those applications himself. And then what happened was, also in this process, you can not only file for your own exclusions, you can also object to other companies' exclusions and say, don't give them that exemption. They don't deserve it. They could get their product somewhere else, or we could make it. So Mike Elrod's business is really small. He has like a dozen employees in South Carolina. His exclusions, though, were objected to by one of the world's largest producers of appliances, especially water heaters. It's a Japanese-owned company, and they do not even produce water heaters in the U.S. themselves. They produce them in Japan and export them to the United States. But their point was, obviously, water heaters come from other places, and Mike Elrod could get them there himself. And by the letter of the criterion that have been set out, that's true. And so Elrod's applications were denied. And even when he tried again to file them more specifically, make a little bit better case for himself, Rheem, this other big multinational manufacturer of water heaters, hired a specialized law firm in D.C., which happens to also employ several former U.S. Trade Representative officials, and they work formally on that account, but it's not hard to imagine they might have advised on how best to make their case, because some of those officials, in fact, did design the whole process.
So these smaller companies who probably can't afford to have the same kind of lobbying and legal assistance are already at a disadvantage, and then the companies that can might actually be trying to undercut them directly through these exceptions.
Exactly. And so it's important to point out that big companies are advantaged at all points of this process, like both by the tariffs, by dealing with the tariffs themselves, because it's easier for a multinational that might have manufacturing facilities in multiple countries to redirect their supply chains or contract with new manufacturers. So they have cash is able to buy you that kind of transition. And then also in this exclusion process, where you have a pre-existing lobbying infrastructure, perhaps, like this company, Rheem, already spends hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on lobbying. They have a dedicated in-house government affairs person. They understand how all of this works. Now, I just want to caution, it's not to say that all big companies automatically get their exclusions, or we don't even know empirically that they're more likely to get exclusions. It's just a hard data problem to crack. But and the process, I should note, is not over. I mean, they're still applying for exclusions, even renewals of exclusions for tariffs that have been in place for more than a year. So there are plenty of big companies that didn't get everything they wanted, but they did at least get the best chance possible.
And very briefly, Lydia, in about 30 seconds, this is also a big impact on the Commerce Department because of the increase in applications and exemptions. Are they even able to handle the workload?
So that's right. It's a really important aspect. I mean, this is a huge extra added workload for Commerce and USTR. they have now dozens of employees who are engaged in the work of making incredibly fine-grained decisions about what types of products should pay tariffs and what types shouldn't. And those are very specific and then probably a little bit arbitrary.
Thank you so much, Lydia, for spending time with us. That was Lydia DePillis. She's a reporter covering trade and the economy for ProPublica. We're talking about how the lobbying industry has benefited from the trade wars and the tariffs with China. Many large companies are employing lobbyists to ask for exemptions. The New York Public Library System is the largest of its kind in the U.S. and has been providing its patrons with books and other materials for 125 years. And recently, they decided to look into what the 10 most checked out books in their history have been. More than half of them are children's books, which makes me very happy. And the book topping the whole list is a favorite, The Snowy Day by Ezra Jack Keats. It's been checked out over 485,000 times since it was published in 1962. Another favorite, Dr. Seuss's The Cat in the Hat, came in second at almost 470,000. Other kids' books in the top 10 were Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak, Charlotte's Web by E.B. White, and The Very Hungry Caterpillar by Eric Carle. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone by J.K. Rowling was also in the top 10, despite being the newest title by quite a large margin. Rounding up the top 10 are four pretty eclectic titles for adults, 1984 by George Orwell, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, Fahrenheit 451 by Ray Bradbury, and How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. The project took 6 months because in true and thorough librarian fashion, they made sure to take into account all book formats, including ebooks and foreign language editions. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll break down the president's claims last week that Iran was targeting four U.S. embassies in an imminent plot. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. In for Rob Ferret, you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.